And what's going on, folks? It is May 23rd, 2013. This is Brandon Easton, and I'm with...
Brandon Thomas.
And this is another episode of The Two Brandons. I believe we're up to episode 8, and we're still growing strong. And I would like to thank all of our listeners who've gotten into some pretty spirited debates on Facebook and on Twitter in regards to a few of our episodes in the past. And I'm really enjoying the discourse. So folks, keep it up and keep on sharing it and letting people know about us. Now today, we're going to talk about a couple of things that are near and dear to me. One is going to be my review, or our review, of Star Trek Into Darkness, and there will be spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie, you're being warned right now that we're going to talk about some key plot points and our feelings on those plot points. Also, we're going to discuss a issue from one of my latest episodes of Writing for Rookies, which is my own podcast, where we're going to discuss how I felt about the culture of geek whining and geek complaining. And I tend to believe that some people may not like what we're going to say, but we've developed a reputation for being honest with the geek community, and we're not going to stop right now. So, with that being said...
It's a nice way of saying you're going to get your feelings hurt.
Some folks might. Well, I'll say this. Intelligent folks won't get their feelings hurt.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that. Now, would you like to discuss your feelings on Star Trek Into Darkness, or would you like me to lead off?
I'd like you to lead off, since you are a Star Trek fan, and I am definitely coming into the movies from a completely different perspective. So let's start off. What did you think of the movie?
All right, well, here goes. I consider Star Trek Into Darkness a tale of two movies. And I'm saying this as a long-time Star Trek fan. I've been a fan since probably 1980 or 81 when I watched the reruns with my grandfather when I was a child. And I didn't understand what was going on, but it looked really cool. If I'm going to break it into two separate reviews, which I probably am going to, as a longtime Star Trek fan, I give Star Trek Into Darkness a 5 out of 10. But if I was an uninitiated moviegoer, I'd probably award it about a 7.5 or 8 out of 10. And I have a lot of reasons for that. But before I get into all that, I will say this. I believe good Star Trek movies or TV episodes have four things working for it. Number one is high adventure with great stakes and high concept situations. Number two is emotional growth of the characters. Did somebody learn something, or did somebody grow on some level? Number three would be interesting space sequences, whether it be battles or the exploration of unique phenomena in space. And the fourth one, which is by no means last, is intellectual integrity. If anyone out there gets the chance, you can look up Gene Roddenberry's original story Bible for the original Star Trek show from 1966. Inside of that Bible is a whole section about the scientific accuracy, or at least trying to be as scientifically credible as possible within the realm of a science fiction TV show that had a low budget. The original Star Trek series did manage to introduce a lot of elements that became real life, like flip phones, cell phones, and lasers being used as weapons, as well as the United Nations creating a planetary protection charter, which does exist, which states that any rocket or any probe launched from Earth to any other, that's going to make landfall on another planet, has to be completely swept clean of microbes, germs, bacteria, or virus, or else we could destroy the ecosystem that we don't know about. So a lot of ways the prime directive in the original Star Trek, as well as a lot of the technology, has made it into our real-world environment. With those four things, high adventure, emotional growth, interesting space sequences, and intellectual integrity, you have the formula for quality, high-quality science fiction. Now, my problem with the new Star Trek movies, which is Star Trek from 2009 and Star Trek Into Darkness, is I feel that the new Trekverse is far too narrow, too confined, and too mired in the desire to blow things up instead of actually exploring anything. In these two new Star Trek movies, I've seen very little to no space exploration at all. In fact, it's called Star Trek, not Star Wars. If you want wars, you can watch Star Wars. But if you want an exploration of space, like within the words itself, its five-year mission is to explore strange new worlds and new civilizations. We didn't really get much of that. I mean, you had an opening sequence in Star Trek Into Darkness where they violate the Prime Directive to save Spock from the volcano, and you saw like a cute little nod to the fact that that alien race is now going to worship the Enterprise as a god. But then we leave that, and we don't really think about it. And it's kind of a toss-away thing that in the original Trek movies and novels and TV shows, doing something like that is something you don't do. It would be like, you know, just going outside and rounding up a bunch of people and just shooting them and walking away from it, thinking, okay, there's no consequences. You cannot interfere with the alien race on the level that they did in Star Trek Into Darkness and have everybody kind of laugh it off. At no point during the time I was watching that movie did I think Kirk would ever answer for any of his misdeeds. And he still didn't, if you watch the entire film. No matter what he did, he came out on top. And the message in that is not very good. What they've done is take a side element of James Kirk's character and centralize that, meaning that he's hyper-reckless and not very considerate. I mean, if you look at the old James Kirk, the William Shatner version, he had a reckless cowboy streak to him, but he was not this reckless, and he was not this unfeeling about the effect of his actions. And that really bothers me. And I think that's because of the Star Warsification of Trek. And Star Trek and Star Wars are not truly compatible. It's not just apples and oranges, folks. It's more than that. Star Wars is an action myth. Star Trek is an exploration of humanity's place in the universe. We're not getting that in these new movies. Now, I would love to see a new Trek movie that balanced the warlike elements with the innocence and wide-eyed sense of adventure of going into uncharted territory in space. We haven't had that yet. And I can't really balance it in my head where a film is called Star Trek, but all we've had for two movies are space battles and war and terrorism. And that's kind of a problem for me. Now, my other issue with Star Trek Into Darkness is that it is a thematic reimagining of the far superior Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. The only thing the new Trek has going for it on that regard is the special effects. And as me, as an adult who wants a little bit more from my movies, the new Trek movies feel like an ADHD version of what Star Trek is supposed to be. What made the original Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan memorable was the fact that it was a rewriting or a rewiring of Herman Melville's Moby Dick with Khan as Ahab and Kirk as the whale. This is why that movie is fondly remembered. Many other reasons, but none of those reasons have to do with the action scenes or the special effects. And even for its time, Wrath of Khan had some incredible space battles and a gripping climax in which Spock sacrifices himself to save him his friends. The way that they flipped that, it had no emotional impact whatsoever because we haven't been given enough character meat to care about Kirk. And we also knew that by the end of the movie, he was going to survive. So at the end of the original Star Trek II, Spock died and was buried at the end of Star Trek II. And it is probably remembered, not just by me, but by a lot of folks, to being one of the most emotional funeral sequences ever committed to film. And Scotty, I mean, those who have seen Star Trek II will remember as Spock's coffin is being loaded onto the torpedo bay, Scotty plays Amazing Grace in Bagpipes, and it is one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen. And we didn't get anything close to that in Into Darkness, considering the fact that they indeed did basically remake Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, but without any of the emotional gravitas. And that's why I can't always recommend this to any. I say that I would recommend this to new fans, but I could not recommend this movie to people like myself who have a working knowledge of the original Star Trek universe and has seen them all and remembers them clearly, and seeing what they did with it, they rewired the old Star Trek, but without all the elements that make Star Trek work. by removing the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy triumvirate as the character core of the movies. I know why they did it, to increase the female participation with Zoe Saldana as Uhura, which is great. But when you don't have McCoy as that third person, you lose a lot of what the movie is supposed to be about and what Star Trek is supposed to be about in terms of questioning humanity's place in the universe. We saw none of that in the 2009 version or in the sequel Star Trek Into Darkness, and that's my take on it.
All right. I guess I'll get started. Now, obviously, I don't know, I've probably said this before in our summer movie preview, yeah, but I have a completely different entry point right into Star Trek, whereas I didn't get into it. I was never a big fan of it. I have a kind of vague working knowledge of some kind of, obviously, I you know, I know the characters. I know that there have been, you know, 800 TV shows. I know Scott Bakula was in one of them. So, you know, I have a very kind of, you know, I have a very minor familiarity and interest level with Star Trek. And the first J.J. Abrams remake, I enjoyed a lot. And, you know, it was probably, and I know, you know, Star Trek fans will probably object to this idea, but it was probably essentially a Star Trek for dummies. Like, these are the barest, most right, essential aspects of Star Trek and its central characters. And we're tweaking a few things and trying to, you know, trying to modernize it in a way that we think will be enjoyable to, you know, a larger mainstream audience, which has been proven, you know, had gotten sick of Star Trek movies for a while. Right. You know, that's one thing that I would always encourage, you know, Star Trek fans to be mindful of. Because there are a reason that these movies didn't exist for a while. Just like there was a reason that there weren't Batman movies for a few years or Superman movies. And, you know, I, you know, loved Star Trek Into Darkness. I don't know if I loved it as much as the first one. I think I'd have to see it another, you know, one or two times before I can make that determination. I think that as far as a sequel is concerned, I think it kind of hit the marks that I think most people want their sequels to hit, to be a little more complex, to be a little more epic, for the danger to be a little bigger, maybe a little more personal. Mm. I enjoyed the movie quite a bit. I mean, to me, as someone who's, you know, kind of idea of Star Trek has been completely kind of informed by the reboot and not the original, to me, Star Trek is about Kirk and Spock. You know, I don't know anything about any of the previous shows or previous versions, but to me, Star Trek is about Kirk and Spock. Those are the main characters, and everyone else is a supporting character, which means they have smaller roles to play in the stories, but essentially the movie is about Kirk and Spock. And as that, as kind of this story about the evolving kind of friendship and relationship between these two characters, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I know that, you know, I know a few of the plot points from the original Star Trek 2. So, I know that Spock dies. I know that Khan is in it. But that I've seen, you know, the famous scene in the, you know, kind of the radiation chamber. So, to me, having them kind of invert that and flip it so that it's Kirk who dies, which, you know, it's temporary, but whatever. I enjoyed it quite a bit. To me, it had a ton of emotional resonance. I understand why people that have seen the original may disagree or may think that it was predictable. But one of the things I would kind of, I hope people would realize is that, you know, maybe this new Star Trek is not for the hardcore Star Trek fans. You know, there are hundreds of hours of Star Trek, Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. There's a lot of Star Trek out there. And for people to expect the same kind of character development and kind of relationship building in these 2-hour chunks is, mm-hmm. I think, a little unrealistic and a little kind of delusional. I mean, if your favorite character is, you know, Bones, I can understand why you would think that, you know, well, hey, you know, Bones only had like 10 or 15 lines and he just right. kind of said a bunch of goofy stuff. But I think the goal of these movies is not to perfectly satisfy every single Star Trek fan out there. And I don't think they're accomplishing that. And I don't think they're even attempting to do that. I think that they are trying to make a mainstream popcorn blockbuster action adventure movie, serial, whatever. And on those lines, I think they're doing a pretty good job of it. I mean, as nerds and geeks or whatever, I know that we have a tendency to sit and nitpick everything and anything about these movies. But the reality is that, you know, none of these movies make any sense if you really think about them. Even the greatest, you know, science fiction, greatest comic book movie has a lot of, in maybe not a lot, but has a few internal inconsistencies. I mean, there to me, there really right. is no perfect movie. And I understand that as a fan of something in the past and the nostalgia that comes with that, I understand that there's a certain amount of expectation that people come into these movies with. But I really think that some of the criticism that the movie has received, and most of that criticism has been from us. It's been from the geek audience. Mm-hmm. The critics seem to love it. People that go to see it love it. But mm-hmm. the hardcore fans are kind of in the background, you know, grumbling about these little things or large things in their minds and the reasons why, you know, well, why did they even have Khan? If I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, when they made the Batman movies, obviously the Joker wasn't in the first Batman movie, but right. people knew that eventually the Joker was going to be in one of these Batman movies. And if he wasn't, people would have been complaining about that. It's the same thing with the Man of Steel. Lex Luthor isn't the villain for this movie, but obviously, if they continue to go forward, Lex Luthor is going to show up, because that's what people expect. And I believe that people expected for them to eventually push the Khan button. You know, they want eventually, they were going to get to it, and they were going to have to get to it, because I think that the fans are, you know, were expecting that in a certain way. And I just don't understand why they expected for this kind of portrayal of Khan to be the exact same version that they saw in the movie. And correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Khan also appear in the TV show before he appeared
in
the
movie? Yeah,
he
was on the episode in, it's called Space Scene.
Okay. Okay, and I mean, that's another thing. This was a, you know, I mean, when they did it before, they had a lot more space. You know, they had a lot more coverage and a bigger opportunity to kind of introduce this character maybe in a more kind of nuanced, subtle, you know, delicate way. But, I mean, this is a summer blockbuster movie. It's a sequel. You know, people want to, the mainstream audience, I don't think really cares about any of that. And I think that right. I would hope that hardcore Star Trek fans would be able to accept the fact that it's just going to be different. You know, it's just right. going to be different than it was before, and just accept it and kind of go into the movie and critique it based on what it is, not on right. what you think it should be or what it would be if you wrote it. And I think if you just kind of approach the movie you know, on its own merits, I think it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty decent, solid movie. It's a little, you know, it's a little loud, it's a little busy, yes, but, I mean, I think that to a certain degree, that's what the audience is expecting. Like, to a certain degree, obviously, you don't want to cater exclusively to your audience. I mean, an example of a franchise that I think is catering exclusively to their audience are the Fast and the Furious movies, which I haven't seen all of them, but I mean, just from seeing pieces of them over the years and seeing the trailers, right, you can just tell that they have abandoned any sense of logic or physics. Yeah, yeah. Or any, you know, this is just kind of bananas, you know, action sequences, people jumping and flying all over the place. And to kind of take that kind of, to basically look at this movie, at Star Trek Into Darkness, and essentially treat it like, you know, Fast and Furious 6, I think is, you know, is, I think is really unfair, and I think it's BS. And I think that people, they just have to accept what something is and just judge it on its own merits. And again, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of Star Trek, and maybe that is probably the primary reason why I feel this way. But I'll, you know, a little later on, I'll, you know, once we get to talking about geek complaining, I'll give you a specific example about how I violated my own rule and the reasons why. But I think that it was I loved it. I don't know if I loved it as much as the first one. I really liked the relationship between Kirk and Spock and the differences between them, and that, you know, this kind of relationship where two people are great friends, but they're very, very different. That's something that relates to me personally. And, you know, we can go and we can pick at it and say, oh, well, you know, maybe Uhura should have done some more. Oh, yeah, there was that weird, you know, Alice Eve scene where she was standing in her lingerie. And, oh, yeah, they explained a lot of this stuff, like, really fast, so fast where you could barely figure out what was going on. But, I mean, I was excited. I was, you know, I was in the movie. I mean, even though obviously Kirk dies, I didn't, just because I was in the scene with them, I mean, I didn't immediately think that, like, oh yeah, Kirk died, but they already, you know, foreshadowed that Khan has magic blood, so he's not going to die, because,
right,
you know, I was in the experience, you know. I try not to, unless the movie is just, you know, chronically, just criminally stupid, you know, I'm not in there picking it to pieces if it kind of feels right, you know. And I we'll talk about this a little later, but I know as a writer, as a fan of writing, I am not, maybe it'll change in the future, but I don't consider myself a technician. You know, to me, it's all about the feel of it. To me, it's about the emotions behind it. And I think that even if something technically, you know, if the climax doesn't occur at the exact point it's supposed to, you know, as long as it feels correct to me, I can, you know, I don't want to say I can forgive it, but I can accept it. To me, that's what I'm looking more for, an emotional connection to some of the characters and what's going on, whether than this is the perfect screenplay and everything makes perfect sense and I can't sit after I'm done with it and pick holes into it until it's Swiss cheese and it doesn't exist anymore. But I loved it. I enjoyed it. If I had the opportunity to see it again, I would encourage people to embrace reason, embrace some common sense, and embrace some perspective, and to let, you know, to let a new generation have a stupid, dumbed down version of Star Trek, if that's what this ultimately plays out to be. You know, you have your Star Trek, you have plenty of it, nothing is ever going to change it, nothing is ever going to change how you feel about it, and, you know, and the inherent greatness of it. But, you know, it's okay to let somebody else, you know, have the characters and be custodians of the characters and custodians of the universe. And maybe it's not as deep and subtle as involved as, you know, the original Star Trek was. But, I mean, we know, I mean, me and you, plenty of people know why that's not the direction that they're anxious to take the franchise into, especially at the beginning. You know, maybe eventually, right, if they keep making movies, they'll eventually get to something that is more kind of quote unquote pure Star Trek. But right now, I don't think that I can completely understand them going in a direction and trying to expose other people to Star Trek in a language that's closer to what people are understanding and experiencing about these, you know, big budget effects heavy, loud, crazy blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it. That's, you know, that's how I'll start. start my ranting about it, and we can, you know, get back into it as we continue.
Sure. Well, you said a lot, so I'm going to try to remember all the points that I wanted to make. Now, the phrase itself, dumbed down, simplified Star Trek, shouldn't exist, because Star Trek was never conceived to be simple. That was the whole point of it. The whole point was that it was going to be a different look at, it was going to be the non-Buck Rogers. Buck Rogers is simple. Star Wars generally is simple. Star Trek is the one that's not supposed to be simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of that's the first side of it. Now, you mentioned Spock, Kirk, and Spock, and see, this is where the background of Trek is vitally important to understanding my point,
mm-hmm.
whereas that all Trek shows, all of them, Star Trek, the animated series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, they all had a triumvirate core emotional cast. In the original, it was Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. On Next Generation, it was Picard, Riker, and Data. On DS9, it was Sisko, Kira, and Odo. On Voyager, it was Janeway, Chakotay, and Seven of Nine. And on Star Trek Enterprise, the last one, it was Scott Bakula's character, which was Captain Archer, Trip Tucker, and I forgot the British guy's name, his character, Malcolm Reed. All of them have the id, the ego, and the superego as the three main characters. That's what Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are. When you get rid of one of them, it tosses off the, it makes it very imbalanced as a character study. Now, it's true, you can't expect anything based on a TV show with over 700 or 800 episodes to have that same feeling in a cinematic experience, because obviously TV is a longer form version of storytelling versus cinema, which is extremely short form, high octane blasts of information, right?
Right.
But my issue really is that I don't feel that a summer blockbuster should be simplistic or dumbed down or loud. Because as far as I know, we both grew up in the 80s, and there were some dumb summer movies, but the movies we remember, the genre movies had a lot of heart, character interaction, as well as the special effect element. I mean, we can think of, not even talking about Star Wars, we can think about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, a film chock with character moments. It was all about the character moments in the Indiana Jones movies. That's what really stands out. If you remove that from the summer blockbuster, then nothing makes it memorable except the spectacle. And that's kind of the thing that I'm seeing in the recent crop of movies. Now, I'm not being hypercritical because I'm not upset about the casting. I'm not upset about anything. I'm just saying that what they've done is, in an attempt to be different, they've kind of lost what Star Trek is. Because Star Trek is not a space battle, united by a space battle, united by a guy sleeping with, having, you know, a threesome with cat women, and all that stuff, getting to another space battle. I mean, that's kind of not Trek. You know, I mean, it would be like in Star Wars, they drank tea for like 2 hours. I mean, they did that in Attack of the Clones. You know, and people had an issue with, you know, they sit there drinking tea. It's like, that's not Star Wars, you know? So all I'm saying is that in an attempt to, I guess, you know, make it more palpable for mainstream audiences, they've lost the things that make Trek Trek to begin with, because this isn't really, this is like if you took a peanut M&M and stuck it into a Snickers. You haven't created a brand new bar. It's still you've got a peanut M&M surrounded by all this other candy. And that's kind of where we're at. Like, we don't have the core anymore. We've got all this candy. And we're not getting to the M&M, you know, if that analogy makes any sense. So, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, and I really want to challenge anyone listening to this, and including you, to think about all the movies that really stuck to you as a kid that were summer blockbusters. I mean, Ghostbusters has a lot going on. There's a lot of great character movement for like five different characters. And in Ghostbusters, you didn't even have a triumvirate. You had five people, actually six if you count Sigourney Weaver, you know, to kind of balance. And they managed to do that. They did that. And they didn't dumb it down for anyone. It was a popcorn movie that had a lot of heart and didn't condescend to the audience. You know, if you think about, I'm trying to remember all the movies. Like Back to the Future, perfect example. That's the perfect example. You say there's not a perfect movie. I would argue that Back to the Future 1, especially, has a perfect formula for what a blockbuster can be, in the sense that you don't sacrifice character for spectacle. Like, those special effects sequences in Back to the Future happened three times in the movie. You know what I mean? And yet, when you saw them, you were exhilarated because you're like, holy crap. Because you finally get to see something really cool in the midst of such incredible character interaction. I mean, the whole film is about a person rediscovering themselves. And I would say if you were to watch Star Trek 2, 3, and 4, the originals, and then watch these two, your entire perspective will be obliterated.
What? My fear is that the originals will put me to sleep or something. I don't know if that's just...
No, I mean, the thing is this. If you really if you watch Star Trek, I mean, I don't know how they would put you to sleep, honestly, because Star Trek 2 is an action movie, but it is very much Moby Dick in space. And it has, and what makes it work is the character development. Because in Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan, you have Kirk grow tremendously between the beginning of the movie and the end. And that growth is so incredibly well handled, just like in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which I think is the best of the three. Oh, well, I forgot the fourth one, but the best of the original. if you look at it, there's such a growth in character, in the sense that where Indiana Jones begins and where his father begins when they meet, they end up in completely different places, and it's a good thing. And that character journey. And, you know, and you're a writer, too, so, you know all about what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, the character journey, I feel, is missing. Maybe I'm missing it. I don't know if my connection – because the thing is, I was ready to leave the old Trek behind, and I'm still ready to leave it, but I'll never leave it. But I was ready to flush it down the toilet because I was like, you know what? I feel that the 24th century Trek, which is what everything other than the original cast is, that kind of reached a wall, so they need to jump ahead. And they kept trying to tell stories – that exhausted that universe's potential. If you can imagine that, they did, but you had what? You had 21 seasons of a TV show in one universe. And you know what I mean? Like, there's only so far you can go without having to reboot. You know what I'm saying? So if you look at the old, you know, they did a lot with those characters, right? I just feel that Chris Pine, who's a good, fantastic actor, and Zachary Quinto, also a fantastic, I mean, the cast is fantastic. I've not criticized the cast. I've not criticized the bizarre science. It doesn't make any sense because even old Trek tried to justify itself with its own, with real physics and Einsteinian physics, whereas this one is just like, oh, anything happens. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never seen a military structure like Starfleet where you're able to blow things up and break the rules and still end up first officer again. I mean, and then get your shit back after you blow it up. I mean, I don't know what kind. Because I'll give you an example. All right, like in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, and then in 3, because it's a trilogy. 2, 3, and 4 are a trilogy, actually. You know, when Kirk gets back to Starfleet at the beginning of Star Trek 3, they're like, dude, number one, you wrecked the ship. Your first officer is dead. You destroyed this big experiment we're working on. Dude, you need to, like, just calm down. You're not even doing anything. You're relieved of duty, right? And the big action sequence in Star Trek 3 is them hijacking the Enterprise out of a space dock that's enclosed. So it's one of the coolest scenes ever. And that's kind of, like, the consequence thing that I'm not seeing in these new movies. Now, I know we only have a certain amount of time, but if it's crafted in a certain way, you can accept that because you could be like, okay, we need to see a person have consequence. All the greatest shows and movies and TV things, shows we love, have. I mean, did you ever watch Babylon 5 by any chance?
No.
Okay. The reason I ask is because out of every sci-fi show I've ever seen, with the exception of Josh Whedon stuff, you know, because in Angel and Buffy and Firefly, there are definite consequences for things people do, right? In Babylon 5, you had remarkable consequences for every decision. Now, the show has a lot of problems, particularly in season 1 and 2, but when Babylon 5 fired on all cylinders, it was easily one of the greatest TV shows, period. Not sci-fi, but one of the greatest TV shows ever made, and anyone who's ever really given it a chance will agree with me. But everyone in that world, every decision they made, there was a tangible consequence. And sometimes it was not so bad, but usually the word consequence is negative. So they had to answer for things. And I just kind of feel that, like, it's too convenient, and it's extremely convenient screenwriting to have things kind of just, you know, whatever, you know, he can just do it. As long as he's on the ship again, that's all that counts. I mean, let's look at the comic book industry. You've read Days of Future Past, right?
Yep.
Okay, and you've read Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. You know, one of the things about Days of Future Past, and particularly Chris Claremont and John Byrne's run on the X-Men, is that there were some serious consequences for decisions made. You know, people did things, and it came back to haunt them in one way or another. Cyclops made some decisions that haunted him even to this day, right? That's one of the few things Marvel has gotten right, is that Cyclops has had a monkey on his back since the death of Jean Grey, you know, on the moon all those years ago, right? Mm-hmm. That's really important. And once again, that is long-form.
That's story. Extremely long-form.
But I'm saying that even in their short runs, you know, in Days of Future Past, you had the whole story was about cyclical consequences. And that was just two issues. And those two issues are considered like some of the greatest comics ever made. You know, Dark Knight Returns. Bruce Wayne's decision leads to a series of consequences that result in that incredible ending. You know, and that's kind of my point, that I'm not one of those nitpickers. I used to be. I mean, I'll be the first to admit. I used to be one of the most nitpicking sons of bitches on the face of the earth, and that was until I moved to L.A. and started working in the industry and realizing that shit can't go the way I think it should go. You know, I understand why they make certain decisions, which we'll get to when we talk about geeks. My feeling is that you don't take the Trek out of Star Trek, you know, and make it kind of like a video game, which it felt like. It felt like a lot of times I was like, where's my controller? I want to play. You know, it felt like I was playing a video game. And I was like, cool. Like the scene when they, it's a great scene when they, you know, do the skydive and from one ship into the other.
Oh,
ship.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's the debris field. I mean, that was cool, but it also felt like a bunch of scenes I've seen in video games. And they also did the same trick in the first movie when they, you know, skydived onto Vulcan to stop, you know, them from mining in the ground. So I was kind of like, okay, this is a two-trick pony, dudes. I mean, how many times?
Yeah, and they made a joke about that. They actually had a line right. That joked about the last time, you know, he had done something like this.
And I totally understand what you're saying, because I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that they did have to change it to make it palatable for mainstream audiences. But my fear is that when you cater to mainstream audiences, a lot of mainstream audiences aren't the brightest people in the world. So I don't think we should collectively dumb down pop culture just to get them in the movie theater. If anything, we should try to make them smarter. Like, that's kind of like how I see cinema. I mean, I don't think cinema should be a pacifying effect on a population. I think cinema has the ability to inspire and to lift people up. I mean, using my own life, when I first saw some of Spike Lee's movies, he had stories in there that I'd never seen in any other movie, because he was speaking to a very specific experience, but he still found a way to explain it to everybody, you know? And it was, but he didn't pull punches in doing that. And I feel that people who came out of Spike Lee movies, in particular Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X, when you walk out of there, you feel something. You feel different, because the movie has dared challenge you to think a little deeply. Oliver Stone's JFK, that's heavy material. But my point is that just because something's big budget and has a blockbuster appeal to it, I don't think it should dumb down the audience or should shoot downward. I don't think art of any kind, even if it's commercial art, should seek to pacify the crowd, because cinema in its entire history, particularly in its early days internationally, was used to make a population more aware of certain situations. In fact, the Russian Revolution back in 1920s was partially pushed by the agitprop cinema. So I think that it's important to have, you know, entertainment, but I don't think there should be a phrase mindless entertainment. I think that entertainment can inspire and uplift, like the Cosby Show, the first five seasons, you know, just because it's popcorn and mainstream. I think at the same time, you can kind of lift people up a little bit. And Star Trek has traditionally done that, and I would like to see it get a little bit closer to that again, while still having the special effects.
Yeah. Okay, listen, this is, you know, I understand all of that. This is my issue with some of the ways people are approaching these movies. First off, you know, a lot of the movies that you just named, those were not blockbuster action pictures.
Right.
I mean, now, like I said, I don't think these movies should be mindless. I don't think they are mindless. And I think the kind of insinuation that they are completely mindless is completely out of whack. However, I'm just talking in a more general sense.
Okay.
I think that some people want Star Trek in the Darkness, just to use a specific example, to tell them something about life.
Right.
To tell them something, you know, particularly poignant or insightful about life. And I don't think any great action movie has, even the greatest of action movies, I don't think you can't compare it to something like something that you just, I mean, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X. I'll use an example of a movie that I saw recently that I thought was pretty incredible. Life of Pi.
Yes.
I haven't read the book. I saw the movie. I was extremely kind of, you know, emotionally invested in this story. Now, right. I don't expect, you know, basically, I don't expect Star Trek or the Avengers or Iron Man or Spider-Man or Star Wars or any of these, you know, movies to affect me emotionally like Life of Pi. And to be frank, Life of Pi isn't even the most, you know, I don't know if the word is not, it's not even the most kind of realistic movie. I'm just using it as a recent example of something I saw. But
right.
I think that people are going into these movies, and I think that their demands are just, they're just never going to be met. I mean, a Star Trek movie now, in 2013, it's not going to teach anybody about life. I mean, right. It can be exciting. It can be, you know, intelligent or borderline intelligent and not willfully stupid. But I think that people are demanding that these movies be something that they're just not going to be anymore. I mean, and also, I think that nostalgia, you know, is playing a huge role in the perception of this. And I'll give an example. Star Wars. I love the original Star Wars trilogy. The first Star Wars movie is the reason that I'm a writer. It's basically the thing that changed my life as a little kid. Now, I know exactly how that movie made me feel and what it did to me. And I know no matter what happens, I am never going to feel the same way I, you know, felt about Star Trek as a kid, because I was a kid. You know, when you see things and you're younger, you know, and they make an impression on you, that impression is going to stay with you. And,
right.
you know, when you grow up and become an adult, I mean, you're just not going to have the same kind of connection to some of this material. And I think that some people are just insisting that, you know, the new Star Wars movies make them feel like they did,
right.
you know, when they were 10. And that's just impossible. It's just not going to happen. and to sit around.
But they shouldn't be bad, though.
Well, okay, it shouldn't be bad. You know, yeah, the Star Wars prequels were bad, you know, and but according to us, they were worse than they actually were because we have this, you know, this strange attachment to them. And I just believe that people are bringing a lot too much personal baggage into some of these movies and their inflated expectations of what they're supposed to be. And I think it just prevents people from enjoying things that they might otherwise be able to enjoy. I'll try to pivot to geek complaining right here. Here's a great example for me personally. For me, I loved the X-Files. I loved the X-Files. Oh, yeah. X-Files was one of my favorite TV shows of all time. I loved it to death. Even though, you know, it was bad when it ended, but blah, blah, blah. Everything is. Not everything, but most things are. So, anyway, I love the X-Files. So, a few years ago, you know, they announced Fringe. And when I see Fringe for the first time and I hear what it's about, I'm doing the geek face. You know, I got my arms crossed and I got that look on my face. I'm like, man, this is just the X-Files. Man, they're just biting the X-Files. They're just going to take the X-Files and give them a bigger budget and put some different people in it and expect blah, 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 blah. All of this, you know, overblown, excessive, irrelevant, you know, geek shit that, you know, a lot of us do occasionally. I did it for Fringe. I hated that show before I saw a frame of it. And that's something else I want people to cop to, because people are pretending that they're going into this stuff and, you know, and allowing the movie to have a chance to do anything. But in reality, they've decided already because of what they heard about it or what somebody said about it that they are going to hate it before they've even seen a frame of it. So anyway, I started watching Fringe. I watched the first two episodes, and I hated it. I hated it just as much as I decided I was going to before I saw it. And I'm like, this show is nothing but a remake of the X-Files. Now they just got a bigger budget, and it's different characters, and blah, 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 blah. So I passionately hated Fringe for a couple of seasons. And after a while, I don't know what happened, but after a while, I'm just like, you know, I decided I was being ridiculous. And you know what? I started to, you know, watch the show kind of here and there. I would watch like a couple of episodes every year. And by the end of it, I watched the last two seasons in full at the end of the show when they were aired. And, you know, I look forward to actually going back and seeing the whole thing over again from the beginning. Because when I actually got over myself and gave the material a chance, I realized that, you know what? Fringe isn't that much like the X-Files at all. And you know what? The X-Files came out in the past, and the X-Files is over. And nothing is going to change the greatness of those first few seasons of the X-Files. It's just not. Fringe cannot erase the X-Files. And on top of that, most importantly, A new generation deserves the right, and they deserve the opportunity to enjoy a sci-fi show on network television with, you know, pretty white people in it that, you know, get together and have babies and it's all cool in the end, just as much, you know, as we did. And I think that that's something that gets completely lost and bulldozed over by this, you know, this kind of geek rampage, this idea that, you know, you're only allowed into the clubhouse, you know, under our specific criteria will allow you to get into the clubhouse. And some of these enraged Star Trek fans are doing the same thing. It's like, well, if you don't like the boring, stuffy, low budget, you know, Star Trek, then you don't really like Star Trek. When in actuality, you know, here's the truth of it. You know how much more likely I am to actually watch old Star Trek now that I've watched, you know, the Abrams dumbed down, blah, 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 reboots, revamps probably 1,000%. Without these Abrams movies, I would have absolutely no interest in anything Star Trek ever. And at the end of the day, isn't that supposed to be the point? Isn't the point of it supposed to be to get more people interested in Star Trek? Who cares what Star Trek you're interested in? If you can get interested in it and you want to watch it and you want to pay money and you want to enjoy it, then that should be the end goal. And, you know, the movie in its opening weekend slightly underperformed, at least domestically. Internationally, it's doing better than it was last time. But when those numbers came in, I wanted to go on Twitter and I wanted to make fun of everybody complaining about the movie. It's like, see, maybe now there will be no more Star Trek movies. So you can have your boring old, you know, 60s, 80s Star Trek and be quiet now. You know, now that Star Trek Into Darkness has come out and has, you know, creatively wrecked the franchise, and mainstream audiences have decided the movie either came out too late or they weren't interested in it or whatever. And people just can't, they just don't have any perspective at all. So if that happens, then they'll be complaining about that. Then it'll be like, well, man, now there's no Star Trek movies. It's like, I thought you hated these Star Trek movies. You know, I thought you wanted them.
I get what you're saying. And I don't think, I'm not saying that, you know, you have to like Trek the way I like Trek. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not even getting close to saying that. I'm saying that what they've created is not really a Star Trek movie, because that's not what Star Trek is. When you see what I'm talking about, then you'll understand where I'm coming from. I'm not one of those geeks that got all, I mean, I'm not offended by anything in that movie. Alice Eve, it was nice seeing her in an outfit. I had no problems with Khan being white, which he wasn't originally. You know, but that's okay. I mean, that didn't bother me. I just felt that it went too much in the direction of action as opposed to actual Star Trekian storytelling. That's my main concern. A lot of people, when they complain about stuff, they're complaining about a bunch of different things, and they are doing the proprietary thing of, well, this is what Trek is and this is what it isn't. I'm completely okay with that Trek existing, but I think that it shouldn't really be. I don't know if the movie should be called Star Trek, though. That's the trick, because it doesn't feel like an actual Star Trek movie. And when you do see those 80s ones, which they don't look that bad. I mean, a lot of them held up extremely well, particularly 2, 3, and 4. Those are the ones I'm constantly referring to. When you see those and then you watch the new ones, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Because I think that it's okay for you to like, because no one's saying, because I don't think a critique of the new movie is any way a roadblock to you and your fandom of Star Trek. I don't know how that will get in the way, because a lot of people, for example, I have no problem with Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith. There are people who absolutely hate it, but them hating it is not going to stop me from liking it. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people who do criticize Episode III, they have really good points that I can't really argue, but it still doesn't mean that I'm going to stop liking it because they have a legitimate critique of it. Because those things can exist mutually without there being, you know, a tidal wave. You know what I mean? Like, you can like the new one, but the people... Now, I think there's a difference between legitimate critique of anything and geek whining. And I think I want to make that abundantly clear. Just because someone has a legitimate critique of something, it doesn't equate to a geek whining. Geek whining is a whole different level of entitled, spoiled, and ignorant ranting, because we see this all the time. I've seen it mainly with the X-Men movies. Like, people hate Bryan Singer and they hate what they did with the X-Men world, where from my perspective, I was looking at it from the perspective of like, well, and we talked about this before, maybe 4 or 5% of the population knew who the X-Men were before this, you know what I mean? And the people they want to get into the movie theater are the people who've never heard of the X-Men movies, which is this massive 95% of the rest of the population. So I felt at the time that X-Men being as complex and weird and wacky as the X-Men universe is, what X-Men slice of the Marvel universe is, you have to find a way to actually simplify that for a larger audience, because you have this insane, wild visual world that's very tough to pull off. And X-Men was something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. And the fact that they made a coherent film about X-Men, to me, was an achievement. You know, because it's very, X-Men, just like Watchmen, in a lot of ways, is extremely incoherent at times. You know what I mean? And when I see people whining about casting choices in X-Men and things of that nature, I wonder, do they understand the nature of the business? And that's what I'm talking about. Like, if someone says, I didn't like Bryan Singer's X-Men movie because, you know, I felt that the effects could have been better. That's a legitimate critique.
Yeah.
I felt that the, you know, the directing could have been tighter, or the editing. That's actually a legitimate critique, because the editing was a bit off in that movie. But that's okay. But just because somebody made that, you know, critique doesn't mean it's going to make me like it less, or they're challenging my fandom. It doesn't mean anybody's challenging your fandom by giving a real critique. And but then on the flip side of that, I've seen critiques of the X-Men movie just insane. Like, why wouldn't they get Tyra Banks? Or why didn't they get, you know, Iman? I'm like, well, Tyra Banks at that time, nobody really knew who Tyra Banks was outside of the black community. And Iman, I'm sorry, I'm not going to go see a movie because Iman's in it. Because once you, well, you know, now I have seen movies because Halle Berry was in it. Case in point, there was a movie called Swordfish. And in that movie, it was the first time we had ever seen Halle Berry topless. So I'm going to be a sick son of a bitch, and I actually went to the movies and saw Swordfish because Halle Berry took her top off in the movie. But I mean, I'm just kind of, that's an extreme example. But I have seen movies because Halle Berry was in it. A lot of people have. So when X-Men 1 came out, and this is something not a lot of people know about my career. When I was in Boston University for film school, I had the opportunity, because the producer of the movie, Lauren Shuler Donner, is a BU alum, and she's produced a ton of movies in her life. And her husband, you know, directed Superman 1 and 2. Her husband also directed the Lethal Weapon series, Richard Donner. I mean, they've been producing and directing movies for decades now. I had the opportunity to meet Lauren Shuler Donner about 4 months before X-Men 1 came out. And she was very uncertain over whether or not people would ever show up to the movie. And I remember one of the things we discussed, you know, after the fact, was that they only had two names of note in X-Men 1. Those two names were Halle Berry and Patrick Stewart. Now, Patrick Stewart was also a toss-up because he was mainly only known by X-Men fans. I mean, a couple people would go see him on Broadway, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Patrick Stewart does not have the cachet of Sean Connery. You know what I mean? In terms of a Brit, you know, a actor from the UK. You know what I mean? And so you read so if you really do the math, the only popular person in X-Men 1 was Halle Berry. And when you got to really think about that. So when I still see and hear these fans whine and complain about X-Men movies, I'm like, you have to understand that they're not making the movie for, you know, the fan base. They're making the movie for everyone else, you know. And I do understand that about Star Trek in a way, but I also understand that about everything else. You know, I, as much as I love the X-Men, and I'm a bigger Spider-Man fan than X-Men fan, and even though that Spider-Man 1 was really problematic when you look at it now, I mean, very problematic, I can tell you, I felt like a child when I saw him swing on a web the very first time. Because Spider-Man was really the first comic book I ever picked up, and a lot of geeks tore that movie apart. And justifiably so, there was some stuff in it that I didn't like, but it didn't take away from me still loving the first time I saw him swing on a web in the costume. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree. I mean, I did a whole podcast about geeks. Like, they don't understand the economics of it. They don't understand the politics of it. They also don't understand that most editors in terms of comics and most producers don't really give a shit about the core fan base, you know. And once you understand that, a lot of the geek angst will go down. But when you try to explain this to people who aren't that smart, and this is something we said earlier, I said to you earlier, I said, I think that when I was a kid, geeks were generally nerds, meaning that they were scientists, math people, or just people who just had above average intelligence, right? But now, since everyone's a geek, you've opened the doors to the lame brain folks. And you've opened the door to not only lame brain people, but incredibly selfish lame brain people. And that's what the problem is with the geek community now. It's not that people are complaining or people are giving legitimate critiques. It's that people aren't giving enough legitimate critique, and they're just fucking complaining all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, obviously, I agree. And one of the things that I think people also gloss over is that they don't understand, or they don't want to understand why major studios don't care that much. I don't want to say they don't care completely, because I think they care a little bit, enough to, you know, still make that money. But one reason that they don't care that much about the geek hardcore fan base is that, bottom line, there aren't enough of us to make their movies right. successful. And right. I think that, you know, a lot of people have this kind of idea of kind of this geek monolith, and geeks are in and nerds are in and Big Bang right. Theory and nerds are running the world. And it's like,
no,
they don't. That's why they're nerds. That's, I mean, I don't, and I think people just don't, they don't want to accept that, and they don't want to come to grips with the fact that their concerns are not the most important to, you know, the process of making these movies or making these TV shows. I mean, they're trying to, you know, they're trying to make money. They're trying right. to make money. There are not, no studio is out there trying to put out the perfect Spider-Man movie for people that have been reading Spider-Man for 25 years.
Right.
They're
right,
not. Exactly. I mean, they think that's ridiculous. They think it's ridiculous somebody's been reading Spider-Man comic books for 25 years. So why would they put $200 million in budget and marketing toward right. realizing some, like, 20-year-old, you know, 20-year-in Spider-Man fans, you know, kind of a fantasy of what a Spider-Man movie can be? And who right. they're going to cast in the roles. And I just, like I said, my main point is just that I just wish people would allow things to be what they are and to try to accept them on their own merits, instead of demanding that things be something that they're not and never going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, Star Trek Into Darkness is just, it's not going to be like the old Star Trek. And there's a hundred reasons why. Maybe it's not as smart and not as clever and not as concerned with reality, you know, with it, as much as the original Star Trek producers were, you know, trying to base their science in some kind of reality. But, you know, I'm sorry, but the people don't want that anymore. I mean, anytime there's, you know, an action movie that comes out that is what people consider smart or intellectual, it's still people out there complaining about it. I mean, Inception.
Well, I have a question for you real quick.
Yeah.
So was it just the Star Trek reaction you were talking about, or were there other, like, geek things that you've seen over the years? Because, like, for me, When I came up with that, I was thinking about all the complaining I saw about the X-Men movies, and then all the stuff that people complain about in comics that they, you already said it, the people behind, and I've already said it too, the people behind the scenes don't care. But what was it that you saw other than Star Trek that made you aware of the geek whining?
Well, Iron Man 3, to be another example. Right. It's basically anything. Dark Knight Rises, Batman Begins, anything that comes out, there are people that are complaining about it. And the people that are complaining about it the most are the people that should know better. And I just want to, anytime one of these movies comes out, I seriously want to, like, leave the internet, you know, for a couple of weeks. So I don't have to, you know, hear a bunch of, you know, like you said, there is a difference between complaining and criticism. But when you read the stuff that people are posting, it's pretty easy to tell the difference. Pretty easy to tell the difference between people saying, you know, hey, internally, even within the logic of the Star Trek Into Darkness movie, or inside the kind of logic box of Iron Man 3, some of the things in that movie that happened didn't make any sense, which is true and is a completely valid response. And it's not what, you know, I'm kind of railing against and I have a problem with. I have a problem with the, like, oh, yeah, you know, Khan was cooler the last time. Well, you know, maybe he was. So what? You know, it's the same thing.
So somebody said that? Because I thought Benedict Cumberbatch was a pretty damn good Khan.
Well, they thought that he just was, you know. Because, you know, Khan was like, he was like jacking folks. He was jacking people up and he was shooting them and jumping out of stuff. And it's like, well, Khan never, you know, he never did that. And he never, it's like, who cares? I mean, it's the same thing with,
you know,
Heath Ledger's modern interpretation of the Joker. Things are going to change, you know, through the passage of time. We're never going to get a movie like the original Star Wars, or like you said, or Back to the Future, or Ghostbusters. If they ever make Ghostbusters 3, anybody that thinks that movie, that thinks that that movie is going to look, sound, and feel anything like that original Ghostbusters movie from the 80s
that's ridiculous.
Stupid. Right. It's like, you know how long ago that was? Nobody wants to see that anymore. And that's kind of one of the things that I wish that people would just kind of embrace and accept. You know, if the old Star Trek is truly over, if they never get back to, questions of mortality and our place in the universe, or, you know, any of the things that the original Star Trek discussed. I mean, would people rather that there is no Star Trek, period? That, you know, it's just Star Trek is just some old show that was on a long time ago and just now it's gone. You know, people have to decide what the prime directive is. That's what people need to decide. You know, what is the main goal with this? You know, is the main goal to serve? I mean, this is the problem with comics right now, the modern comics industry, and the fact that they keep servicing this aging, dying fan base. And I know that the producers of these movies are concerned that if they're just like, well, wait a minute, you know, this is not Star Trek anymore, we should go back and make Star Trek how they used to make it and just give us a bigger budget. They are concerned that the modern audience is going to say, oh, so wait a minute, so this is just like, so what is these, like sequels to like some movies from like the 90s? I mean, it'll be like that new Indiana Jones movie where it's just like, this movie should not exist. You know, Indiana Jones had its time and it's over now. And, you know, and that's just, you know, something geeks need to practice, need to let go. You need to let it go and just let it turn into something else that has nothing to do with you, that is not trying to service you and your demands and your needs for this franchise. I mean, that's what, internally, that's what I have done with the Star Wars movies. I mean, before they announced Episode 7, which still seems strange and weird to me, but I mean, before even the Star Wars prequels, I mean, you just have to accept, you know, these Star Wars movies are not being made for me anymore. They're just not. And that's fine. You know, that doesn't mean that that's not a personal affront to me. You know, that doesn't mean that, like, George Lucas doesn't care about me, or George Lucas is, you know, is destroying my childhood, or what, all of this nonsense that, you know, that people have said and people have printed over the years. I mean, geeks, You just gotta let it go, man. Just let it go. Just let it be.
You know what the sad part is, and this is really one of the most important parts, is that a lot of people don't have an identity outside of their hobbies. And when you have a population like that and the numbers that they do exist, you'll get people who replace real-world relationships and real-world interactions with imagined affairs or friendships with these characters. You know, I think really that's the core of it, that so many people, like, I love Star Wars. I love Star Trek. I love Spider-Man. I love Robotech. I love Transformers. But I don't own any of that stuff. I don't have a right in the end to try to stick a proprietary flag into any of it. You know what I mean? And that's kind of my thing. Like, I learned that, well, because you didn't know me back in the 90s and early 2000s, but I used to be an obsessive Transformers fan, you know? And I was so angry that the rest of the Transformers stuff couldn't be like the 80s Generation 1 cartoon. And then I bought the 80s Generation 1 cartoon and realized out of 96 episodes, only 13 were watchable.
Yes.
You know, and but those 13, there was something in it that I still hope that they can kind of recapture. But when you look at out of all that, only 13 are worth watching, you know, I understand and accept that. Okay, things have to change. And I also have something called friends and family that I can, and I go outside a lot. I used to work in an animation store when I was in Boston, and I didn't realize how bad fandom could be until I worked there. I worked at this store called Anime Crash, and if there's anybody out there listening who lived in Boston in the late 90s and early 2000s, and we were in Harvard Square, we used to sell Japanese animation and related material in Hong Kong cinema. This is how, incidentally, I got introduced to Chinese movies, like the John Woo stuff and all the Yin Wen Ping and all that, was through working at this store. And anime and Hong Kong cinema fans are some of the worst fans on the fucking planet. Like, you want to talk about nitpicking, you want to talk about fetishism, you want to talk about disconnect from reality. Anime fandom, and I don't give a shit who is offended by what I'm saying, anime fandom are fucking weirdos. You know, they're wacky, they're strange, and they are the stereotypical geek. Now, not all anime fans clearly are not like that, but when I worked at that store, we used to keep a can of Lysol behind our desk for many reasons. One, and I'm telling you, to disinfect the store and get the smell out, because some of these people clearly did nothing except, you know, masturbate, eat fast food, watch anime, and masturbate again. Like, that was their life. And people like that, you know, there's people in comics like that, there's Trek fans, there's Star Wars fans, there's Fantastic Four fans, whatever, there's video game heads. There are people like that, and that's the problem, that it's not just that these things are either dumbing down or whatever we all feel, whatever our arguments will be. It's that maybe our society has changed to the point where people take this stuff too seriously.
Yes. I would definitely co-sign on that.
Right, because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to put, you know, God bless, Siskel and Ebert both have passed on, and I grew up watching those guys, but their critique is not the same as the geek critiques we see. You see what I mean?
Right.
Like, if Roger Ebert has a legitimate critique of something, I'm going to give that dude a lot of weight, no pun intended, to what he has to say, you know, because that dude has proven he knows what he's talking about. He's just not criticizing it from some bizarre space mentally, you know what I mean, or emotionally. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, you know, the G.I. Joe movie. I really hated the first one, but it wasn't because it wasn't like the old cartoon. It was because I just didn't like the movie at all, except for like two scenes with the ninjas and stuff, because I really like Storm Shadow. You know? But, you know, the G.I. Joe fans, a lot of them grew up collecting the dolls or the action figures, whatever you want to call them, and they take it so personal that the actor doesn't look like the doll. And I'm like, they're not going to look like a doll because that's plastic. You know what I mean? You know, and I completely understand what you're saying. And so that's where I'm coming from when I talk about this stuff. I'm just thinking that I feel that there's a whole generation of geeks out there who either by birth, by accident, or by design, or just because they're just insane and ADHD obsessive or Asperger's like, they've latched onto these worlds on such a level that they can't accept any version other than the one that's in their head. You know, whether it be X-Men, Star Trek, Star Wars, you know, what are they remaking? What else are they remaking? G.I. Joe, Transformers.
Everything.
You know, Voltron, you know, exactly.
Time Cop.
Well, yeah, right? But, you know, but I mean, I think you understand where I'm coming from,
yeah,
when I say that, you know, I do think that, I don't know what your experiences are like with fandom. Like, mm-hmm. I know you do the convention scene, you sign your books, you go out to conventions. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people I see embarrass the shit out of me for being a fellow comic book fan. And I have to say that because some of these people, I'm like, dude, you're the reason everyone used to make fun of comic book people. Because the assumption is we're all like that guy. You know what I mean? Dude, oh my God. Anyway, I could talk about this subject for like 14 hours, man. Yeah. But
I can too. I guess we should let them go.
I don't think there's anything wrong with loving this stuff. I just think that there's a problem when you get to the point where you don't realize that it's a creation.
Right.
You know, there are people who have crossed that threshold into believing that this stuff is real. And I don't mean it in that textbook term, but I mean it in the sense that they take it way too personally. Like, it's supplanted. It's replaced real-world relationships. Like, there was a girl I met in Boston once who didn't like Harrison Ford at all, but she wanted to date Indiana Jones. And I'm like, but that's Harrison Ford. She's like, no, I want to date Indiana. Like, she literally meant this. Like, this wasn't a joke. Like, she wanted to find Indiana Jones as a living being and take him as her husband or something, whatever she wanted to do with him. And I was like, but that's Harrison Ford. And she just didn't get it. Like, I was like, that's Harrison Ford. And I kept saying that. And that's what I mean. There are people who think these characters, like people who are mad about Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. I'm like, the dude, he did a good job. I'm sorry. I mean, maybe he's 6 feet tall, but there's not a lot of people who could probably pull that off and take it seriously. Exactly. He takes it very seriously. You know, you put an American actor who doesn't really care about X-Men or anything and put him in that role, it's going to suck. But here's a guy who was hungry, who wanted to get his name out
hungry.
There. And he took,
hungry. Dude,
he took that role so seriously that he's got two spin-off movies.
Yep. Not only that, he's built a career off of that.
Exactly.
Nobody knew who Hugh Jackman was until Wolverine.
And most people don't know who Wolverine is. That's kind of my point.
Right.
Like we said last time, or I don't know if we had said it, or I said it on my podcast, I'm like, if you go up to random people on the street, they only going to know certain heroes. Superman, Batman, you know, maybe Spider-Man, you know, but you're not going to get too far past that first tier of heroes. Before X-Men 1, if I said Wolverine, people think I'm talking about the college football team. You know? Because I used to say, man, Wolverine's my favorite character. And they're like, what? You watch college football? Why do you care about Michigan? And I'm like, what? You know? You see what I mean?
Yeah. I understand. I know that was a lot of stuff that we just, you know, kind of hit everybody with. But, you know, this stuff isn't real. These are imaginary characters. You know, the movies and the books and the cartoons you loved in the past are still there. They're probably out on DVD. They're streamable on Netflix. Nothing can ever change that. And sometimes you just gotta let it go. You just gotta let it go. Everything is not for you. And a new generation of, you know, of kids and young adults deserve the opportunity to experience these, you know, endless revamps and remakes on their own terms. And, you know, without having to worry about whether or not, you know, that makes them real fans of the franchise or not. You know, I just want people to just keep perspective and stop deciding that you're going to hate stuff before you've even seen it. I mean, people are not given this stuff a chance. You know, they're deciding that they hate it sight unseen. And I mean, it seems like the older you get, the less, you know, people are supposed to do that as adults. But I see a lot of, you know, adult comic book fans and other adult comic book writers that are still doing the same thing that, you know, most of us have grown out of. So,
well, and I'll say this, you know, as a capper to this, even with my reservations about J.J. Abrams' Star Trek universe, if they made a third one and the same people made it, I would still go give it a chance. Even with my reservations, because I'm willing to see where they go with it, where they're going to go with it. And that's kind of my point, that even if I have a critique of it, I'm still going to give the next shot a chance. I'm just not going to write them off.
Right. Because you never know. You never know what's going to happen. You never know how you're going to feel, time the next movie comes out. Your life may be completely different. You may be interested in a bunch of different things than you were even 2 or 3 years ago, and it'll just hit you differently than this one did for whatever reason. But Star Trek Into Darkness, it's in theaters now. I think you should go see it. Easton, I don't know.
Well, no, I think though what I said, if I wasn't a fan, I would give it a 7.5 or an 8. As a fan, I give it a 5. So
so if you're not a Star Trek fan like me, go see it. You'll enjoy it. It's cool. The effects are great. Yep. It's a nice little, I think that basically when I saw it, I was a little more, I don't want to say comforted is too strong a word, but I think that Star Wars Episode 7 will be certainly interesting. I think it'll certainly be better than the prequels, but we'll see. It'll be fun. I mean, whoever thought? I mean, even Star Trek fans, who thought that they were just going to, that they would revamp the franchise one day and do everything over and get a bunch of young, pretty people to play these famous characters? And whoever, no one ever thought, except me when I was 10, that there would be an Episode 7. So, we live in interesting times, and you touched on this in your podcast. We are very fortunate to have the amount of stuff to bitch and complain about that we do today. And, I would just like people to keep that in mind, that we're fortunate, to keep having Batman movies and Superman movies and Star Trek movies and whatever.
Because, it's going to be real interesting to see what people think about Man of Steel.
Oh, my God. I'm so ready. I'm ready.
All right. On that note, I got another I actually have another teleconference.
All right. Let's cut it off. We'll talk about Man of Steel when it comes out, I'm sure. So thank you guys for listening to another installment of the Two Brandons. Think this is our longest yet, probably our most passionate yet.
That's all right.
Yeah, it's all right. That's all right. It be like that sometimes. So, we will see you guys next time, and take it easy. Thanks.
Take care, everybody.